Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
I think it's the people directly affected by terrorism, violence, and war that are going to be the ones to show us the answers to those problems.
Civilian casualties, civilian solutions. David Pattorti lost his brother on September 11th and has spearheaded a movement against war and violence ever since. It's called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. But first, New Yorkers gather at St. Paul's Chapel, across the street from the former World Trade Center, to demand the federal government stop ignoring the health effects of 9/11.
Forget about me. I've had a lot of onset illnesses. I've lived my life. Take care of our kids. Set up these clinics at our schools. For God's sake, help our children.
And we'll look at another September 11th, 1906, when Mahatma Gandhi launched the modern nonviolent resistance movement. We'll speak with Gandhi's grandson, Arun Gandhi, about Satyagraha. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Bush continued his series of speeches around the anniversary of the September 11th attacks Thursday with a new call for Congress to approve his warrantless spy program. In a theme Republicans say they'll pursue in the lead-up to the November elections, the president said his policies have made the country safer from future attacks.
We are safer because we've taken action to protect the homeland. We are safer because we are on the offense against our enemies overseas. We're safer because of the skill and sacrifice of the brave Americans who defend our people.
As the president spoke, a bill to authorize the spy program hit a major roadblock in the Senate after Democratic Senator Russ Feingold introduced several amendments. Feingold said, quote, "The president has basically said I'll agree to let a court decide if I'm breaking the law. If you pass a law first that says I'm not breaking it, that won't help reestablish a healthy respect for separation of powers. It'll only make matters worse," he said. The president's call comes one day after he urged Congress to approve the White House's proposed revisions to military tribunals at Guantanamo. On Thursday, several key Republicans and military lawyers said the president's new proposals would not withstand legal scrutiny. Brigadier General James Walker, the Marines' top uniformed lawyer, criticized the administration's attempts to retain provisions that would deny defendants the right to see evidence used against them. According to the New York Times, Walker said no civilized country should deny a defendant that right and that the U.S. should not be the first. In Europe, President Bush's acknowledgement of his administration's secret prison program is prompting calls for increased scrutiny of CIA activities. This is Sarah Ludford, a British member of the European Parliament.
So I think it will give renewed determination to members of the European Parliament and our temporary committee on extraordinary rendition to get answers from Europe's leaders. And I think we have a much stronger basis on which to demand those answers.
Meanwhile, Thursday, Europe's top human rights official called for the monitoring of CIA agents operating throughout the continent. The official, Council of Europe Secretary General Terry Davis, said he would support a review of the process granting U.S. agents diplomatic immunity. He said, quote, "Immunity should not mean impunity." Davis also called for a ban on the transport of suspects in military planes. In Afghanistan, at least 18 people are dead and more than two dozen wounded after a suicide car bombing struck a U.S. military convoy earlier today. Eight Afghan civilians, two U.S. soldiers are among the dead. The attack comes as the U.S.-led NATO force is appealing for more troops, helicopters, and planes to continue its mission. This is NATO spokesperson James Apatharai.
This is in many ways moving into territory with which we were not familiar. No international forces have been there in a sustained way. And, of course, the Taliban have substantially, it seems, upgraded capability to resist in terms of its tactics and in terms of the numbers that it is massing.
Meanwhile, Al Jazeera has aired a new video showing Osama bin Laden meeting with some of the hijackers who carried out the September 11th attacks. The footage shows two hijackers delivering what's believed to be their last statements before 9/11. In Iraq, There are growing signs of what the Washington Post calls the most dramatic surge in violence of the U.S.-led occupation. On Thursday, Baghdad's morgue said it's nearly tripling its count of violent deaths last month. Officials have revised the toll from 550 dead to more than 1,500. Meanwhile, the health ministry says it's approved construction of two morgues to accommodate the rising death toll. In another development, the Pentagon said Thursday U.S. troops are being targeted with more roadside bomb attacks than ever before. Around 1,200 improvised explosive devices, IEDs, were set off in August, four times more than in January of 2004. IEDs are the leading killer of U.S. troops in Iraq. Meanwhile, the Iraqi government has shut down another television network inside the country. On Thursday, officials said Al Arabiya's bureau in Baghdad will be closed for a month for inciting violence and carrying, quote, unprofessional reporting. Al Arabiya's main rival, Al Jazeera, has been barred from Iraq for more than 2 years. In Lebanon, Israel has lifted its air blockade, but it'll continue its naval siege for at least another 2 days. Israel says it's made the move because UN forces are not ready to patrol Lebanon's coast. Within moments of the lifting of the air blockade, a Middle East Airlines flight from Paris circled over Beirut three times in celebration before landing at Rafik Hariri International Airport. In the occupied territories, a senior UN official's warning living conditions for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip is reaching a breaking point. The official, UN Relief and Works Agency Karen Abu Zeid, said Israel's ongoing military offensives and economic blockade is creating suffering and mass despair for Gaza's 1.5 million residents. Abu Zeid called on the international community to send an influx of foreign monitors. Back in the United States, the Bush administration's ongoing effort to win Senate approval of U.N. Ambassador John Bolton is again facing internal Republican opposition. On Thursday, Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island said he will not vote for Bolton unless the Bush administration or until the Bush administration answers his questions on U.S. policies in the Middle East. Chafee says he wants the Bush administration to block Israel's expansion of its settlements in the occupied West Bank. Senator Chafee is facing re-election this year. Bolton was given a recess appointment last year after his nomination failed to win enough support in the Senate. After weeks of increased speculation, former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage has admitted he was the primary source to reveal the identity of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Armitage maintains the disclosure was an error, and he did not know Plame was a covert operative. On Tuesday in Washington, D.C., we will interview the authors of the new book that exposed Armitage. We'll talk with Michael Isikoff and David Korn. And finally, more than 5,000 people gathered on the National Mall Thursday in support of the rights of undocumented immigrants. The We Are America Alliance rally comes as House Republicans announced Thursday they'll launch a new effort to pass several border crackdown measures before their recess next month. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
Here in New York, hundreds of residents gathered last night at St. Paul's Chapel across the street from the former World Trade Center site to demand the federal government stop ignoring the health effects from 9/11. Juan, you were the moderator of this event. Can you talk about it? It was very heated.
Heated and emotional. Hundreds of people poured out, political leaders, scientific experts who talked about some of the studies that have been done, both of Ground Zero workers and residents of the area. And then, of course, the community itself. Many people, too many actually, to be able to speak because there was a time limit to get out of the church. But they basically raised the same questions over and over again. 5 years later, there's been very little done by the government at the national or local level to begin treating and dealing with the enormous health problems that persist and will be persisting for decades among both residents and Ground Zero workers.
So let's watch just an excerpt of what happened.
Yes. Well, at the meeting, residents had a chance to share their concerns with federal 911 health coordinator John Howard, who was there. This is what they had to say.
Diane Lapson, I am the president of the Independence Plaza Tenant Association. For everybody here, there's at least 100 people that aren't here. And the most sick are not here because they can't. I think the biggest sickness that we all suffer from is the fact that the people who lived downtown, were so brave and so amazing and helped and volunteered while fires were burning, while we knew we were risking our health. Our federal government never thanked us for the hard work that we did down here, and we're suffering greatly. Everybody's sick, and the wonderful American government that we all waited for has not arrived.
Catherine Freed, I was the council person at 9/11, and what I want to speak about is I live downtown 24/7. I didn't leave after 9/11 except for 1 week because my doctor told me I had bronchitis. If I didn't get out of town, I was going to have pneumonia. I went away for a week, and I came back. And several months later, at Dr. Steve Levine, at a hearing in the city council, heard me coughing and said, come see me immediately. And then he diagnosed me as having chronic chemically induced bronchitis with reactive airways. And I found out that, like many other people, I had, because of the causticity of the air, my entire respiratory system was burned. The same kind of symptoms, and by the way, I still have problems with breathing today. If I'm around a match or anything strong chemical, even strong perfume, I still get chest pains. I still can't breathe, and my breathing now is so bad that where before 9/11 I used to do 45 minutes flat out in a treadmill, now I'm huffing and puffing when I just make it up the steps of the subway. But like what Diane said is true. We're all still waiting. I fought as hard as I could with so many of the people here because we knew what was going to happen. We practically begged the federal government to listen to us. I was down at the site maybe 2 days, and I'm proud to say it's because I snuck in those independent environmental testers so that they could get the truth out of what the air was like. But, you know, we're still waiting. Whoever made, when the EPA lied to us, when the city decided it was more important to open up Wall Street and to open up our schools and our health, you know, it's like collateral damage, which is what I feel like. And I think that's what we were. If I'm going to die 20 years too early, I at least want to know about it, and I want to know now what I can do about it, as does everybody else in this room.
My name is Karen Newton, and I'm a member of the Beyond Ground Zero Network. Well, with all due respect to the scientists and the doctors that have investigated this problem, everybody who lived down here knew this was a problem from the very beginning. We knew that this air was toxic. We went on from the very beginning to say that this air is toxic, our kids have asthma, I'm having breathing problems, and the only thing that we were told was to go back to work, to stay in our homes, to keep breathing that air, and to clean it up ourselves. This is a time for action. This is a time for the federal government to take direct action. We need comprehensive medical care. We need long-term solutions now. I want no more taking baby steps, no more half measures. Right now, here today on the fifth anniversary, we declare as a unified residents and workers in Lower Manhattan that we will not wait any longer because we had to band together from the very beginning. We had no other choice. We had no other resources because the attention that was paid was not on the people who stayed in Lower Manhattan. And we banded together and started a program at Bellevue Hospital. We banded together and protested in the streets when everybody was saying that it was fine. But I call on everybody sitting here, whether it's elected officials or government officials or doctors, residents, and workers, we need to come together and say we will not tolerate anymore the waiting. We will not tolerate anymore the half measures. Today, we will act because I do not want to be back here 5 years later and keep saying the same thing and congratulating for one little more effort.
My name's Tom Goodkind. I'm nobody special. I'm just a resident of downtown Manhattan. I gotta say to most of you guys who are here tonight, I saw you a few years ago and I thought you were a little kooky. I came down with my family and I believed almost everything that was said. And my kids are at home and they're screaming and yelling at me now for coming back. And when my daughter told me, hey, Daddy, why do all of the children at our local school, PS 89, have these inhalers now? What are they? And let me tell you something. I don't think any of the groups have looked at the children of our neighborhood. And I mean, forget about me. I've had a lot of onset illnesses. I've lived my life. Take care of our kids. Set up these clinics at our schools. For God's sake, help our children.
Hours before the town hall meeting, the Bush administration's top health official, Health and Human Services Secretary Michael Levitt, met with New York legislators. He vowed to give the $75 million for September 11th health programs. This is Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney of New York.
At our meeting, Secretary Levitt said he was going to put the A-team on this issue now. Well, I felt like saying it's 5 years and now we're getting the A-team. What did we have? The B-team? The C-team? No team? What do we have? But I'm glad that the A-team is now being put on this issue 5 years later after people have been dying and people are sick. And my question to the officials in the city of New York who finally came out with the guidelines 5 years later, we have the SARS guidelines out, we have the Asian flu. Why did it take them 5 years to be able to send to our doctors the protocol of what to look for people who were exposed to those deadly toxins? And I mean all people, residents, school children, workers, not just the responders, our heroes and heroines, but all people. It took them 5 years to get it out. And in one of the reports from Mount Sinai, they reported that 30 to 40% of the people who came to their monitoring program were misdiagnosed and medically mistreated and misdiagnosed. Again, I ask our government with this responsibility, how in the world, after the heat wave, you can come out and give us a report, a detailed report, that 8 people died during that heat wave. Yet we don't have one official report on how many people died because of 9/11 health-related issues. On 9/11, and we have to remember, because of our responders, it is listed as one of the greatest rescue efforts in the history of our country. I was here on 9/12, and our officials thought the death toll was near 25,000, maybe higher. Up to 3,000 people lost their lives. But we have to come to grips that many, many more thousands lost their health. And this government that is spending $300 billion in Iraq has got to spend some money on treating the people who are here working to help the people in our city.
New York Congressmember Carolyn Maloney. On Thursday, the former head of the Environmental Protection Agency defended the agency's role after 9/11. Christine Todd Whitman was interviewed by Katie Couric on 60 Minutes.
The readings were showing us that there was nothing that gave us any concern about long-term health implications. That was different from on the pile itself at Ground Zero. There we always said consistently, got to wear protective gear.
That's Christine Todd Whitman, former head of the EPA and also former governor of New Jersey. Juan, more and more is now coming out around Christine Todd Whitman.
Yes, and actually she is now obviously blaming Mayor Giuliani and the city for some of the problems of lack of protection. So now the finger pointing is beginning to spread to higher levels. The reality is that there's plenty of blame to go around for both. There was actually a National Institute of Environmental Safety and Health study in early October of 2001 that said, yes, there was a problem that most of the workers at Ground Zero were not being properly protected, but that the city of New York, as incident commander, see, the problem was that for a long time in the first days of after 9/11, the site was being treated as an emergency rescue operation, and therefore the city of New York, the fire department, and Mayor Giuliani were in charge. Once it became clear that no survivors were left, which is what only took a few days, at that point it really became a recovery operation, and the federal government should have stepped in. However, Giuliani insisted on maintaining control of the site, and the government, the federal officials, safety officials, did not dare to challenge him. As a result, nobody was making sure that the workers were protected. So while Christy Whitman is right that the mayor and the city bear responsibility because they control the site, the federal government had the legal authority to step in and take over and assure that everybody was being properly protected.
And just a few days ago, we played that clip yet again of Christine Todd Whitman a few days after 9/11 assuring people that the air was clean, that people could go back to work.
Right. That's one of the reasons why the rescue workers didn't really listened when they were told, listen, you've got to wear a respirator. There weren't even, in fact, enough proper respirators to be able to use, but those who did have them didn't use them all the time because they had been told that the air was safe by Christy Todd Whitman.
And I just want to say, I mean, now your paper, the New York Daily News, has been spearheading a campaign of concern around the rescue workers, around those who cleaned up September 11th. But you won very early on when your paper wasn't doing that, but you were, as a columnist in the paper, were continually going after this issue at a time when the establishment didn't want to talk about this because it meant disrupting not only New York business, but because the New York Stock Exchange is based here, it meant disrupting business in the world.
Right. Well, and of course, as Richard Clark has made clear, the order to reopen Lower Manhattan came directly from President Bush. And in his book, Against All Enemies, Richard Clark says he was in the White House Situation Room when the president gave the order to the Treasury Secretary that he wanted Wall Street up and running within a week. And it was up and running within a week. And now all of us are facing the consequences of that decision.
And unfortunately, a lot of people, as they try to run, are gasping for air. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by David Pitorti. He lost his brother on September 11th and has never stopped now working to end violence and war in the world. Stay with us.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand?
Sarah Thompson, is it for freedom? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we continue our coverage of the fifth anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. We're joined by David Pitorti. His brother James died at the World Trade Center shortly after the attacks. David joined with other families, members who'd lost their families, to form a group that called for peace. As President Bush announced his war on terror, they advocated for nonviolence. They called their group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. David Pitorti is now the group's director. We welcome you to Democracy
Now! Thank you.
Now.
Thanks, Amy and Juan.
Can you go back 5 years and talk about that day? Where were you? Where was your brother?
I was living in Cary, North Carolina, which very strangely was, I think, the headquarters of American Airlines. And the first phone call from one of the flight attendants came to their headquarters where I lived. And my story is probably very similar to everybody else's story. You know, I got a call from, I think, my mom because my sister-in-law had called her. I was sitting on the edge of the couch, turned on the TV, and just saw that horrible scene that everybody had seen of the World Trade Center. And I knew that my brother worked on the, you know, one of the upper floors of the North Tower. I didn't know the exact floor, but turned out to be the 94th floor, and that was the direct hit by the first plane which took out about 300 of his fellow employees.
Where did he work? Himself.
Marsh & McLennan, which is a multinational insurance company. So they were just gone. So we didn't get a phone call from Jim. And didn't really figure out until that Friday that we wouldn't be hearing from him. So that's really when our mourning began, just a few days later. And after that, because I was already working for a newspaper and doing commentaries occasionally for Pacifica, I had this sort of platform to talk about my opposition to our government's response, because from the very beginning, I just knew, looking at my parents who are still alive and seeing how they were suffering from this, I said, I don't want anybody else to have to go through this. And how can we use a smart response, a sensible response, that does not result in the deaths of other innocent people? And obviously, we've got to get the people that did this in some way, but let's be smart about it. And as a result of putting things out on the internet, some other families got in touch with me. Also heard from Kathy Kelly, who you know from Voices in the Wilderness, and she was organizing a peace walk from the Pentagon to the World Trade Center in November of 2001. And a bunch of us, maybe about five of us, did this symbolic peace walk. And you had us on when we arrived in New York, November of 2001. And
I remember
about
that
it.
Moment. You were there with Amber Amundsen,
right?
Who had lost her husband.
At the Pentagon.
At the Pentagon. And I remember this famous picture in the New York Times of all of you at Union Square. And Amber was wrapped in the American flag. And I can't remember exactly what the caption on the picture was, but it made it look like it fit, that you were all part of a group that were calling for some kind of, or supporting the U.S. government and supporting for an attack.
She was a grieving widow, and I was a grieving brother. And that's pretty much it. And we just did a walk from, I don't even know if they mentioned the walk, but it was just like, here's some grieving people standing in Union Square Park. Wrapped in the American flag. And we're all carrying signs that say, no war in Afghanistan, stop the bombing, and they just cropped all of them out. So it was just the two of us, grieving. And that was our first experience of the media covering us, but not really covering us. They covered us, but they didn't say the context of why we had arrived there. So that gave us a taste of what was in store.
And as you began to bring together your group, obviously there were several organizations that developed out of the families of the victims of the attacks. What was the reaction or interaction that you had with some of the other families that were grieving as well over the positions that you took?
Well, all the 9/11 groups, we support all of them, and they all have their particular niche. Some of them are about compensation for families of firefighters, redevelopment of Ground Zero, what's going to go there. We're really the only ones that are involved in kind of the political end of it, talking about U.S. foreign policy and how we can change that and make that better. And so we kind of all coexist, we support each other's work. We certainly support the work of all the other families. We've never really told anybody that they don't have a right to respond the way that they want to. So we're happy to allow people to respond however they want.
How much media attention you get when you go from description, describing your loved ones lost at the World Trade Center or the Pentagon, to prescription? What should happen?
Well, most of the media we get is from overseas, strangely enough. Everyone's fascinated with us. Even people in China have written about us as being, look, this is what Americans do. This is part of the American character. They're marching. But we find in the United States, they're really just interested in kind of the human, the human element. Tell us your story of grief and woe. And they really don't want us to talk about the prescriptive part, as you describe it, and how we can actually change things and make things better. And that's really still the case nowadays. It's very hard to get coverage of our actual message in this country.
And when you see what's happened in this country over the past 5 years in the name of fighting the war on terror that really was sparked by 9/11, your sense of what's happening to the country?
Well, I'm just terrifically sad at what's happened. It just, the fact that this is still being done in my brother's name and in the names of all these other people who died, it's just terrifically sad and anger-producing for me that so many people in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Lebanon and Israel, the Middle East, all of these civilian casualties are just growing and growing and growing out of September 11th. And we were talking about exactly this thing happening after 9/11, and that's why we're saying we had to be smart and think about our foreign policies and go back to the, we talk a lot about the post 9/11 world. The post 9/11 world that I like is the couple of days after 9/11 when the whole world came together and said, let's stand in solidarity. That's the post 9/11 world that I want to go back to, not the one that I currently live
in. But now you've also, your group now has begun to meet on an international level with other groups of families who have suffered through tragedies. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, we just spent 4 days up at the Garrison Institute, which is a retreat center just north of New York City. And we've really kind of come full circle with Peaceful Tomorrows. Right after we announced our group, we began hearing from groups around the world, like I think Yitzhak Frankenthal with the Parents Circle. It's a group of Israeli and Palestinian parents who are trying to create peace. They've all lost their children. We were getting emails from a woman named Jo Barry, who I think is on your show. Her father was killed by an IRA bomber, and she managed to meet with his murderer and to kind of reconcile with him and try to understand him. We heard from the Hibakusha, who are the wonderful Japanese survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, who just worked tirelessly to end nuclear war and nuclear weapons. All these people started writing to us and said, we really support you. We really want to, lend our help and just our moral support to you. And that just went on and on. We heard from Father Lapsley in South Africa with the Institute for Healing of Memories. One of our members went and attended a Healing of Memories workshop on the 10th anniversary of apartheid.
And Father Lapsley, who we've had on Democracy Now! A number of times, had his hands blown off,
right.
Lost his eye when the as being a part of the ANC and the anti-apartheid movement,
right.
Was sent a letter bomb.
Right. So all these people reached out to us, and as this went on and on, we said, wouldn't it be great? We would go to their countries and speak and learn about all their wonderful work, and we said, wouldn't it be great if we could bring all of those people here to the United States and expose the American people to the fact that there are alternatives to war that we don't hear about? All we hear about is we've got to drop more bombs, we've got to kill every terrorist, and that's never going to happen. So we actually yesterday did like a mission statement for this new organization. And I can tell you about just a couple of the people that came. We had Olga Takaeva from Russia. She's a member of the Mothers of Beslan. We just commemorated the Beslan tragedy a couple days ago. She was present during that tragedy.
Hundreds of kids killed.
Right. So now she works to help in recovery efforts in terms of their psychologies and helps them to get into schools, the people that were left and affected by that tragedy. We had Asma Gefnifi. She has a group in Algeria called Group Hicham, and her brother was murdered by Islamic terrorists. And she was then threatened with death because she would not wear the hijab or the headgear, so she had to move to France. And she started a group against fundamentalism. Beatrice Abril and Jesus Abril are from Madrid, and he lost his son in the Madrid train bombing, and they started a group called the 11M group. To seek truth and justice about the attacks, who caused the attacks, which were originally blamed on the Basque separatist group ETA. Viviana Mantragola is from Italy, and she has a group called the Liberia Association. Her mother was a politician in Italy, and she was murdered by the mafia because she was trying to save a public park from being developed by real estate guys. The mafia killed her, so her daughter has started a new group lobbies for laws which confiscate mafia lands and convert them to public use. So they turn mafia lands into parks or into gardens. So all these people with their groups came together in Garrison. Pete Seeger came up and played for us. It was just wonderful. And we all met and talked about how can we stay in touch with each other? How can we amplify each other's work? How can we share their work with Americans and the rest of the world and kind of build on what we're doing? And what's really unique about this new group, which is as yet unnamed because we just did our mission statement, is that we are, all of its members were directly affected by terrorism, violence, and war. Some of them were actually in terrorist attacks. Febi Isran came from Indonesia, and he was injured in the Jakarta Marriott bombing in, I think, 2003, and was disfigured, burned, his hands were disfigured, and he started a group called Forum 58, and they support terrorism survivors in, like, the people from Bali and other people in Indonesia.
Rwanda.
Rwanda, we had a couple of Jean-Baptiste Ntakarunamana and Father Romain Rurangirwa, both from Rwanda. Both of them lost extended members of their family, I mean, in some cases, dozens of members of their extended family in the Rwandan massacre. Father Romain is now a Roman Catholic priest. Jean-Baptiste has a group called Orphans of Rwanda, and they try to support the survivors. But to meet these people and just see how they've managed to carry on, I mean, they're so similar to us. They've just dedicated their lives to peaceful resolution of conflict. It was so inspiring for us, and those are the people that really keep us going. That's why we want to share them with Americans, because we think their stories will keep Americans going, too, and give them hope.
And your hope now is to begin publicizing the group or to promote the idea of social peace and change coming from the activity of citizens themselves.
Right, from the grassroots, right, absolutely. Can I read you our quickie mission statement? We literally wrote this yesterday. This is the first time it's ever been read. May I read it to you?
Sure. Okay, new folks, group. A Democracy Now! Exclusive. David Patorti reading the mission statement of this new international gathering dealing with civilian casualties, civilian solutions.
Right. We are a global network of organizations comprised of people who lost loved ones to or were directly affected by war, nuclear weapons, terrorism, genocide, organized crime, and political violence. We work together to break the cycles of violence and revenge and are committed to honoring the memories of the victims and to the dignity of the survivors. Using our collective experience and skills, we are dedicated to identifying and addressing the root causes of violence and to promoting nonviolence as the most effective strategy for resolving conflict. We pledge to support and amplify each other's efforts across diverse communities, recognizing that we derive our strength from our common experience of loss and our common hope for a world free from violence.
Well, if people want to get in touch with you, the website?
PeacefulTomorrows.org. We're doing maybe 14 or 15 panel events in the New York City area with all of our wonderful international guests. I'm going to head over to NYU right after this and introduce a panel with Jody Williams, the Nobel Peace Prize winner for her campaign to ban landmines. And we have Phil Donahue hosting a panel with us, Peter Yarrow playing at the New York Society for Ethical Culture on Saturday night. And we'll try to post write-ups about all these things for people that aren't in New York. We'll try to post that on our website, what went on there and what was said.
And we hope that some of you will join us at some point on Monday night. Democracy Now! Is celebrating its 10th anniversary, bringing out voices of peace and resistance at Cooper Union. And I do want to encourage people who live in this area to come on out in Lower Manhattan. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, for more details on September 11th. And David, in the midst of all of this and the organizing you've done over the last 5 years and the grief for your brother and the celebration of life that you, I think, very much embody, you wrote the book, September 11th Families, mm-hmm. for Peaceful Tomorrows, in front of you under the framed picture of your brother.
Many
different languages. It's
It's been you know, this is the original, I don't know where I'm holding it there. This is the original book. We have it in Japanese, which is just a lovely book. We have it in Italian. We have it in Spanish. And it's just so great to know that, you know, our small sort of words are out in the world and being read by other people. It's very empowering.
David Patorti, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're going to turn now, before we go to Arun Gandhi, to another of your members of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. We first talked to Rita Lazar years ago when she lost her brother. And in the coming weeks, we're going to go to her to talk about what she did. In addition to being a part of this organization, she went to Afghanistan and talked about the similarity and the rubble she saw there and the rubble that she saw at the World Trade Center. But for a final moment, I wanted to get your response to President Bush. On Monday, he admitted the Iraq War is straining the psyche of our country, but vowed to stay the course. A reporter questioned him about why he opposed withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq.
A lot of the consequences you mentioned for pulling out seem like maybe they never would have been there if we hadn't gone in. How do you square all of that?
I square it because imagine a world in which you had Saddam Hussein, who had the capacity to make a weapon of mass destruction, who was paying suiciders to kill innocent life, who had relations with Zarqawi, imagine what the world would be like with him in power. The idea is to try to help change the Middle East. Now, look, part of the reason we went into Iraq the main reason we went into Iraq at the time was we thought he had weapons of mass destruction. It turns out he didn't, but he had the capacity to make weapons of mass destruction. But I also talked about the human suffering in Iraq, and I also talked the need to advance a freedom agenda. And so my answer to your question is that imagine a world in which Saddam Hussein was there, stirring up even more trouble in a part of the world that had so much resentment and so much hatred that people came and killed 3,000 of our citizens. You know, I've heard this theory about, you know, everything was just fine until we arrived, and then, you know, kind of the stir up the hornet's nest theory. It just doesn't hold water as far as I'm concerned. The terrorists attacked us and killed 3,000 of our citizens before we started the freedom agenda in the Middle East. What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing, except for it's part of, and nobody's ever suggested in this administration that Saddam Hussein ordered the attack. The lesson of September 11th is take threats before they fully materialize, Ken. Nobody's ever suggested that the attacks of September the 11th were ordered by Iraq.
President Bush, in August. David Pattorda, your response.
Well, the problem with propaganda is that it's quite boring and predictable, and this is just propaganda. You know, we've heard all this before, and I'm really quite tired of hearing 9/11 invoked for the Bush agenda. And I think the people we need to be listening to are the people of Iraq when it comes to whether it's time for us to leave Iraq. And the people of Iraq want us to leave Iraq. They want us to set a timetable. And if we're talking about democracy, let's listen to the people of Iraq. And they want us out of there. And I think that's what we should do.
David Pattorda, thanks for joining us. When we come back, the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. It was on this date 100 years ago that Satyagraha was established. We'll ask Arun what that word means. Stay with us.
Tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Please tell me the reason you want us to unify. You say you're sorry, said there is no other choice. But how can you feel sorry when you kill people with no voice? We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution to hunger and disease. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace.
Michael Franti, Bound the World, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country and world, on Pacifica and NPR and PBS, radio and TV stations, on public access TV, on low-power FM stations, on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, DirecTV Channel 375, and we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also in Spanish at our website, democracynow.org, in transcript as well as audio form, and any radio station can take those. As we continue to honor this date coming up, September 11th. Juan?
Well, September 11th, 2006 has a special significance. It not only marks the fifth anniversary of the attacks on New York and Washington, it also marks 100 years to the day that Mahatma Gandhi launched the modern nonviolent resistance movement. Gandhi called it Satyagraha.
The date was September 11th, 1906. Speaking before 3,000 Indians gathered at a theater in Johannesburg, South Africa, Gandhi organized a strategy of nonviolent resistance to oppose racist policies in South Africa.
Satyagraha was born. And since then, it's been adopted by many around the world to resist social injustice and oppression. Gandhi used it in India to win independence from the British. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King used it in the United States to oppose segregation. Nelson Mandela used it in South Africa to end apartheid. Today, we mark 9/11 by looking at Satyagraha. Arun Gandhi joins us from Rochester, New York, the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi and co-founder of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Memphis, Tennessee, which promotes nonviolence in conflict zones around the world. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Arun Gandhi.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Can you define Satyagraha for us?
Satyagraha is the pursuit of truth. My grandfather believed that truth should be the cornerstone of everybody's life, and that we must dedicate our lives to pursuing truth, to finding out the truth in our lives. And so his entire philosophy was the philosophy of life. It was not just a philosophy for conflict resolution, but something that we had to imbibe in our life and live it all the time so that we can improve and become better human beings.
And the spread of the concept and the movement around the world, looking back now at its impact, could you talk about how it spread and the impact it's had on social change around the world?
I think it has had a tremendous impact. As you just said in the introduction, so many people around the world have used nonviolence as a way to resolve the conflict that they faced in their lives. They continue to use it everywhere all over the world there. And I think in a way, nonviolence is our nature. Violence is not really our nature. If violence was our nature, we wouldn't need military academies and martial arts institutes to teach us how to kill and destroy people. We ought to have been born with those instincts. But the fact that we have to learn the art of killing means that it's a learned experience and we can always unlearn it. And I'm always reminded of a very pertinent statement that my grandfather made. He said, violence will prevail over violence only when someone can prove to me that darkness can be dispelled by darkness. And I think that's what we have to remember and try to imbibe in our lives there, that we can never overcome violence with more violence. We can only overcome violence with respect and understanding and love for each other.
Arun Gandhi, can you tell us what your grandfather, Mahatma Gandhi, did 100 years ago today?
Well, as you said, he met in the theater with more than 3,000 Indian people because they were victims of prejudices in South Africa and all kinds of unjust laws were enacted to oppress them and suppress them. And he realized that this was not right and that we should not submit to these things and should not live with this. And so he got the people together and explained to them that we have to resist this kind of injustice and we have to do something about it. We should not just submit to it and live with it. And people were wondering, how can we resist with the state so powerful and we don't have any weapons? Because every time even today, when somebody talks about resistance, everybody thinks in terms of weapons and war and fighting. And that's when Grandfather explained to them that we don't need any weapons of mass destruction. We have the ability to respond to this non-violently and with self-suffering. And that's what he encouraged the people to do, and they came out into the streets with love for the enemy. Grandfather didn't tolerate any hate for the enemy or any anger for the enemy. He said nonviolence has to be complete nonviolence. We have to have love and respect for the enemy, and that is the only way we can overcome them. And And that's what he showed in his work. And I'm amazed that the Prime Minister of South Africa, General J.C. Smuts, later on he admitted that grandfather was the greatest. He called him a saint, and he said it was my misfortune that I had to be against him. And it was that kind of feeling of reverence and awe that he inspired even in his opponents. And I think that's what we have to remember and try to make it a part of our lives, because violence is destroying us. You know, we're seeing violence growing every day in our streets, in our homes, in our towns, in our cities, in the world itself. Everywhere we turn, we see violence and hate and prejudice and anger and all of these negative emotions that are destroying humanity. And we have to wake up and take note of this and try to change our course so that we can create a world of peace and harmony where future generations can live happily together.
For some of our younger listeners, especially, who may not be aware of the specific ways in which your grandfather carried out his movement, especially in India, could you talk about some of the tactics used or the key moments in the fight for Indian independence? And also, I'd be interested in your perspective on how you see how India today is either carrying out, whether people are either carrying out or have forgotten much of the lessons of Gandhi?
Well, nonviolence is something very powerful, and the power behind it is not weapons, but the support of the people. And grandfather had this knack of picking on issues which really affected a lot of people everywhere, and therefore he was able to get people to come out and join his movement. Now, to give you an example, the Salt March that took place in 1930, when he announced to the nation that he was going to defy the salt laws enacted by the British, and defy the British government. Even the Congress Party members who were his supporters began to doubt and wonder. He says, how can you destroy the British Empire by defying the salt laws? And, everybody ridiculed the idea, and even the British ridiculed the whole idea, and grandfather remained steadfast there. But the reason why he picked on the salt law was that that was one law that affected everybody, Hindus and Muslims, rich and poor. Everybody across the board were affected by that law. And when he decided that he was going to march 247 miles to the sea.
And if you could explain why that law was so oppressive to the Indian people?
Because the British had decided that they were going to take the Indian salt back to Britain and refine it and repackage it and sell it back to the Indian people at about 20 times the price. And, enormous taxes were imposed on salt. And India had been impoverished by the British colonialism and imperialism, and people were very poor, and this kind of tax on salt, something that everybody needs every day, was totally unjust, and therefore grandfather decided to defy this. And when he marched that day, began the march 247 miles to the sea, it just caught the imagination of the people, and millions of people poured out into the street. And even if they couldn't participate in his march, they did things in their own cities to defy the British. And the response was so tremendous that the Congress doubters also began to see the wisdom of it, and the British government were taken completely by surprise. And I think that was the turning point in the freedom struggle in India. from that point onwards, the British lost their hold over the country, and it just went down to ultimately giving independence to the country there.
And your work in the Middle East, Arun Gandhi, how have you applied Satyagraha?
Well, I had the opportunity to go there in 2004, and as it turned out, I was the last foreigner to have met Yasser Arafat and to have spoken to him. And the message that I took to the people in the Middle East is that this kind of violence that you are committing is not beneficial to you or beneficial to anybody. You are only destroying a whole generation of young people and not achieving anything. And lately, after 2001, after the terrorist attacks here, everybody in the West has been looking at suicide bombers as terrorists. And so instead of gaining sympathy for the cause of the Palestinian people, you are only gaining more anger and frustration, and people are branding you as terrorists, and you're losing the battle there. So I tried to suggest to them that they should take re-examine their whole procedure and see what they can do non-violently to achieve their goals. I suggested to them that Napoleon, the greatest military general that the world has seen, has written in his book that the general who holds the initiative has better chances of winning the war. And I said, in this case, you are not holding the initiative at all. It is the Israelis who are holding the initiative, and they are making you do things that they want you to do. And that can justify more violence and suppression of your people.
What was the response of President Arafat, who had spent his whole life in armed resistance, basically, to free his people?
Well, one of the questions that he asked me was, well, suppose you were given the leadership, what would you plan to do? And I said, look, I can't give you an offhand answer to this question because it needs to be studied properly. I need to be here. I need to understand the problems here. But one thing that really comes to my mind here, I said, I had just been to Amman, Jordan, where I had met with more than 500,000 refugees, Palestinian refugees, who were living for more than a decade in awful conditions, and they were frustrated and angry, and they wanted to come back to Palestine and live a peaceful, normal life there.
You have 10 seconds.
I told Mr. Arafat, I said, suppose you were to go there and lead this 500,000 people, men, women, and children, in a march to Palestine, and no armaments or anything, just say that we are coming back to live in peace and harmony in our homeland. Can the Israelis kill so many people and live with their conscience? I said the whole world would wake up and stop this action.
Arun Gandhi, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I hope to see you in Memphis on January 11th on our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour. And I want to let our listeners and viewers know on Monday the movie Gandhi will play all over the country on the 100th anniversary of Satyagraha on Democracy Now! On Monday, we'll have a debate on 9/11, joined by Dylan Avery, who made the film Loose Change that raises questions about what happened September 11th, and we'll be joined by the editor, David Dunbar, of Popular Mechanics, that has put out a book called Debunking 9/11 Myths. Democracy Now! Will be celebrating our 10th anniversary and be honoring those who honor this moment in history at Cooper Union. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.